Today, we are continuing down the GI tract in our podcast series, and we have arrived at the duodenum. My name is Catherine Germanski, and I am a gastroenterologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. A big thank you to Dr. Jewel Samatter, who is joining us today from Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, to discuss the management of duodenal neoplasia and familial adenomatous polyposis, also known as FAP. Dr. Samatter, would you briefly introduce yourself and tell us more about your role in the care for patients with FAP at the Mayo Clinic?
Thank you, Dr. Germanski, and the CGA for inviting me on this podcast. Well, I'm a gastroenterologist with a specific focus on hereditary cancer conditions. After completing my gastroenterology and cancer genetics training at the University of Michigan under Steven Gruber, I moved to the University of Utah and co-led the hereditary GI cancer clinic there with Dr. Randy Burt. He helped develop my clinical and research focus, and specifically in the area of FAP, helped mentor me in the design and execution of a large clinical trial looking at chemo prevention for FAP. I subsequently moved to the Mayo Clinic in Arizona when a new cancer center was opened in 2017, and here I work with our nurses, advanced practitioners, and gen counselors to see patients with inherited cancer syndromes.
Wonderful. So let's jump right into this. How common are duodenal polyps and cancers in FAP?
That's a great question to start with. Well, duodenal cancer is the leading cause of cancer-related mortality in FAP after the removal of the colon or after colectomy. Up to 80% of FAP patients will develop duodenal neoplasia, i.e. adenomas, throughout their lifetime. The lifetime risk of duodenal malignancy is 12 to 15% in most studies, and likely closer to 20% when you include ampullary tumors as well.
So which of our patients with FAP should be concerned about duodenal involvement?
Though we don't have a good genotype-phenotype correlation for duodenal neoplasia in FAP, we do seem to see a track within families. Thus, if a parent has severe duodenal disease, it is likely their offspring, who also has FAP, will develop duodenal neoplasia throughout their lifetime.
Where in the duodenum do you typically see these polyps and cancers present?
The polyps can develop in any part of the small bowel, the most common being the duodenum, extending from D1 to the D4 segment. As you transit further in the small bowel into jejunum and ileum, typically less and less polyps occur, and thus less often distal small bowel cancers. Remember, the polyps in the duodenum typically do not have the mushroom polypoid appearance of those in the colon. Instead, they can be very flat or sessile in appearance.
So this is very fortunate because this location is amenable to surveillance with routine endoscopy. When should these patients start surveillance with endoscopy?
Absolutely. Surveillance is a key part, and the fact that it is within reach of most of our endoscopes is a good thing for these patients. Surveillance endoscopy should be started at 18 years of age or prior to their colectomy to ensure there is not a synchronous neoplastic lesion in the duodenum at the time of colon resection.
How should surveillance be conducted in these patients?
The endoscopist needs to have training, experience, and expertise in seeing patients with FAP. They need to have the ability to examine the ampulla with either a side viewing endoscope or a cap. The ability to deal with sessile lesions in the duodenum with EMR using a saline lift technique is also a great asset.
So in your opinion, can a general gastroenterologist without advanced endoscopy training also perform this endoscopy?
Yes, of course. They just need to make sure they do a slow, thorough examination of the duodenum, which may involve multiple pullbacks to ensure they are visualizing all the corners, folds, and surfaces of the bowel. If they are not comfortable with a side-viewing endoscope, they could either learn to pass one with the assistance of an advanced endoscopist in their group or use a cap on the end of their endoscope.
As you mentioned earlier, these polyps tend to be very flat and can be harder to detect than a pedunculated mushroom polyp. Do you recommend the use of any adjunct tools in duodenal surveillance in FAP?
Not specifically. For example, dichromoendoscopy and narrowband imaging are tools used in endoscopy in both the upper and lower GI tract, but they have not shown specifically great benefit in examining the duodenum. The one caveat I will place is that the St. Mark's practice in the United Kingdom does use chromoendoscopy for rectal pouch surveillance.
That's quite interesting. So what is an endoscopist looking for in the duodenum of a patient with FAP besides just a flat polyp? Are biopsies necessary or helpful in any way?
Remember, the lesions are very sessile, unlike the pedunculated polyps in the colorectum. There are likely multiple microadenomas as well. We're usually only concerned about removing lesions greater than 5 millimeters if there are numerous polyps present. The ampulla should be visualized yearly, but I only biopsy this area if there's a lesion close to 10 millimeters in size, as I have found a random biopsy of a nearly normal appearing ampulla in FAP often results in adenomatous histology. There's also a small risk of pancreatitis with even a cold biopsy of the ampulla, so it's best to reserve this for when there is a lesion that may actually need to be resected.
Many people reference the Spiegelman score. Could you tell us exactly what the score is and whether or not you find it to be a useful tool versus something that could be improved?
The Spiegelman score is made up of points for number of polyps in the duodenum, the size of the largest polyps, the level of dysplasia, and histology. It is used to help guide the interval for repeat endoscopy and also the need for surgical assessment for stage 4 disease. The Spiegelman stage is based on very limited and historical data from the United Kingdom, and thus it may not be representative of our patients today who receive regular surveillance as well as EMR or even ESD to remove larger polyps to decrease the long-term cancer risk.
In the age of EMR and even ESD, how does an endoscopist decide on the appropriate resection technique?
I think there's three options that we should look at when we think about treatment of polyps in the duodenum. One, and probably number one, is probably the easiest and most gastroenterologists will be comfortable with this, which is cold or hot snare with saline lift polypectomy. This allows you to have a complete resection of the lesion. Hopefully a negative margin around it can be ascertained by the pathologist. And if it's a cold snare, obviously lessens the risk of post-polypectomy delayed bleeding. Number two is endoscopic mucosal resection, so an en bloc polypectomy if possible. The other option for a very sessile nature polyp growing along a fold would be an endoscopic submucosal dissection, especially for those where a biopsy of the lesion has identified high-grade dysplasia. Obviously, an ESD would require referral to an expert center with an expert gastroenterologist who's comfortable doing ESD. The final option I often utilize is argon plasma coagulation. This can be utilized to treat persons who have multiple small polyps distributed throughout the duodenum where polypectomy isn't really feasible, or even it can be used to treat these margins of a resected EMR site.
It's incredible how far we've come in removal of duodenal polyps, especially those large sessile polyps. When would you say surgery is required for duodenal polyp removal beyond these advanced techniques?
That's a very important discussion, both between the physician and patient, as well as the physician and the surgeon. Remember, a Whipple, which is the most common surgery to remove the duodenum, is morbid and involves recreating a biliary pancreas anastomosis. We can consider a second option, which is a wedge resection of the duodenum if there is an isolated single large adenomatous polyp. For patients, however, with Spiegelman stage 4 disease, the current standard of care would be referral to surgery for consideration of a duodenal resection and ultimately a Whipple. Again, I have to reiterate that this is based on historical data, but it is the current standard of care.
So let's shift slightly to the topic of an ampullary adenoma. If the polyp is an ampullary adenoma, does the criteria for removal or type of approach for removal differ?
That's a great question. So the criteria I generally use surrounding ampullary adenomas to decide on whether to pursue an endoscopic or even surgical removal is, one, if the lesion is over a centimeter in size, two, if there's villous or high-grade dysplasia on histology, three, if there's increased liver function test suggestive of biliary obstruction, or if there's symptoms related to biliary or pancreatic obstruction. Often this can be done through an endoscopic approach. Obviously, it should be handled by an experienced advanced endoscopist due to the risk of bowel perforation, pancreatitis, biliary and pancreatic ductal strictures that often will require multiple repeat interventions or ERCPs. I would also recommend inspecting the ampullary growth for intraductal involvement or invasion of the muscularis propria layer with EUS. And if this is present, most endoscopists would prefer to refer this to a surgeon.
That's funny you mentioned that. I was just about to ask you whether there were any tools available to help you make this decision between endoscopy and surgery. Could you comment on endoscopic ultrasound?
Well, I think it's important to use endoscopic ultrasound in tandem with ERCP or an MRCP if EUS is unavailable in your site. This can help determine the invasive aspect of the ampullary lesion, including the depth of invasion into the muscular propria or submucosa, and importantly, the growth into the duct. Remember, if the tumor is growing into the duct, it can rarely be removed by an endoscopic ampullectomy approach, and surgery is preferred. Importantly, these ampullectomies as well as surgical therapies should be done at high volume centers.
Now, a high volume center is a great idea because there are risks of endoscopic removal of ampullary lesions. Can you remind us again what those risks are?
Absolutely. Ampullectomy or even surgery of this area is not for the faint of heart. The risks of endoscopic procedures include bowel perforation, bleeding, acute pancreatitis, which can be at least 5%, and most importantly, probably in the short term, is strictures of the colon bile duct and pancreatic duct that can lead to cholangitis or pancreatitis, and often in the long term require multiple repeat ERCPs for stenting.
Now, if surgery is recommended, what are the options for surgical type? I know we mentioned wedge versus Whipple before.
There are three main surgeries that I think of, which are ampullectomy versus a pancreas-preserving duodenectomy versus a pancreatic duodenectomy or a Whipple. Again, I would advise referring the patient to a high-volume center that has expertise in hepatopancreatobiliary surgery, and they could have an informed discussion with the patient of the surgical options depending on the extent of disease they have and the best approach and the complications that can result.
Beyond the length of the procedure and prolonged exposure to anesthesia, what are the risks of surgical removal?
Well, you can have altered anatomy after the surgery, and that leads to further shortening of the small bowel, which can lead to problems with nutrition and hydration. Remember, these patients already have lost their colon. The surgical sites themselves can be an impetus for the formation of desmoids, as you well know, can be very difficult to treat and can lead to compression of vascular as well as bowel, leading to a lot of morbidity for our patients.
Now, what are the risks for recurrence of these duodenal polyps, and how can we minimize these?
So ongoing surveillance with endoscopy every 6 to 12 months is indicated after a large polypectomy or ampullectomy is performed. Remember, the altered anatomy can make surveillance of the small bowel difficult, or the native ampulla if it has been preserved and re-anastomosed in a roux limb.
Dr. Samatta, this has been an excellent discussion so far about surveillance and subsequent treatment and intervention. As you know, our patients often like to be proactive and ask, what can we do to prevent duodenal polyps instead of just watching and waiting for them to occur? As a result, I'd like to switch to the topic of chemo prevention. What patients are most likely to benefit from chemo prevention, and what are the current drug choices?
Thank you for transitioning to that area, Katie. As you know, this is an area that I've been actively involved in for many years and really feel a strength in discussing. In general, I would say that patients with at least Spiegelman stage 2 disease or higher would be the ones that would benefit most from chemo prevention today. Maybe in the future, if we have the right drug, we would use chemo prevention even earlier in patients with stage 1 or stage 0 disease to ensure they never form duodenal polyps. But at this time, I think thinking of patients with stage 2 and higher disease is best. Sulindac was the initial drug that showed some promise for chemo prevention in FAP with a 30% reduction in colorectal polyposis. However, the effect of Sulindac in a related COX-2 specific NSAID, celecoxib, was ineffective in the duodenum, showing only a 4 to 14% decrease in polyps in a large RCT. This lack of efficacy of traditional NSAIDs led to further research which postulated that the APC mutation led to not only increased COX activity, but also parallel signaling through the EGF receptor. This led to the design and execution of a phase 2 clinical trial in Utah that I was intimately involved with that used a targeted inhibition of the COX signaling pathway with Sulindac and the EGF receptor signaling pathway with erlotinib. Erlotinib, as you know, is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor of the EGF receptor, which is typically used for the treatment of lung and pancreas cancers. However, in the above chemo prevention trial, erlotinib was used at 50% of the oncology dose to lessen its side effects. This trial was actually stopped early by the Data Safety Monitoring Board due to the statistical endpoint being reached. The results were then published in JAMA in 2016 and showed a greater than 70% decrease in duodenal polyp burden in FAP patients after only 6 months of therapy.
Those are impressive results. As we try to find the best type of chemo prevention for our patients, could you comment on what you feel is the ideal type of drug to serve as a chemo preventative agent in FAP?
Well, the best drug would be similar to water, with no side effects whatsoever, tolerated by nearly all patients, and highly efficacious. Unfortunately, there's no drug like that. So we are looking to balance the benefit of the drug, which is the prevention of duodenal cancer or need for morbid surgery or high-risk ampullectomy, with the risk of the medication itself, which is often not trivial. Remember, with NSAIDs, there is a risk of bleeding, stroke, cardiovascular events, and with erlotinib, there's an increased risk of diarrhea, acneiform rash, and even interstitial lung disease rarely. Chemo prevention has not worked in the general population due to the adverse risk of medication. For example, even a small increased risk of bleeding or cardiovascular events can be substantial if treating hundreds of thousands of people in the general population. However, I think this is where the role of chemo prevention in these hereditary cancer syndromes is so intriguing. For example, in FAP, where the risk of duodenal cancer is substantial and the risk of surgery is not trivial, it makes sense to use these medications while finding a balance with their adverse effects.
This was an excellent explanation of what a chemo preventative agent should be. Are you currently using any chemo preventative agents in your practice right now?
Because of the experimental nature of many of these agents and the fact that most of the trials have been short-term trials, I don't actually use any of them in our standard of care clinical practice. If a patient is interested in chemo prevention or would benefit from chemo prevention, I usually offer them one of the clinical trials that are currently ongoing looking at chemo preventative medications. The one caveat I would make is that in a patient with rectal polyposis whose status post-colectomy with an IRA, I will use Sulindac sometimes to help with the polyp burden management in the rectum.
Great, thank you for that clarification. So are there any ongoing or upcoming studies that are promising to you right now?
There are actually multiple studies either ongoing or just recently completed that we should be excited both to hear about the data, see where they go, as well as hopefully our listeners can think about referring their patients to some of these studies. The first one is the DFMO Sulindac study, which was sponsored by Cancer Prevention Pharmaceuticals. This was a phase 3 double-blind, multi-center randomized clinical trial. The results were recently presented at DDW, and though they were not positive on the intention to treat analysis, there was a signal for colorectal polyp regression in the subgroup analysis. I think we will be hearing more in the future about subsequent studies using DFMO to elucidate its effect in the colon specifically. The second trial is a follow-up of our phase 2 erlotinib study. This is an NCI-funded trial using erlotinib once weekly instead of a daily dose. This is hoping to reduce the side effect profile that you see with daily dosing of erlotinib. It's currently actively recruiting with a goal to finish enrollment in September 2019, and final patient follow-up will occur in February 2020. Thus, we think that data should be available by ACG 2020 for sure, and possibly as a late clinical trial addition to DDW, hopefully. The third trial, which is just getting up and running, is using a very novel pathway, which is the cytokine interleukin 23 inhibitor, guselkumab. As I said, this is a monoclonal antibody against interleukin 23. It's an phase one randomized clinical trial being supported by Janssen Pharmaceuticals.
So we've got some exciting prospects and some actively enrolling trials. If we have providers listening today, how would they go about finding more information about these trials to see whether or not they could have their patients enrolled?
Thanks for that question. We're always looking for patients who would be interested in these trials, both as a treatment option for themselves, but also to help future generations of FAP patients, as well as possibly their offspring. Really, the goal of these trials is to offer our patients hope and possibly one day in the future offer a medication that can either delay the time to surgery or delay the need for regular interval colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. To get more information about the erlotinib NCI-funded trial, they could contact either myself or Dr. Paul Lindberg at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. We're the co-PIs for that trial. And for the guselkumab trial, this is being run by Janssen Pharmaceuticals. The listeners are welcome to contact me if that's easiest, and I can forward their information on to the Janssen representatives. But there are sites running across North America right now with this trial, and you can probably search for it on clinicaltrials.gov.
Now, as you mentioned, screening for and management of duodenal polyps can be quite burdensome for our patients and their family members. What resources do you recommend to your patients to assist with coping?
It's important for physicians and counselors to develop a long-term relationship with their FAP patients, so they know that the team is going to be with them for many years and likely treat others in their family as well. By establishing this strong therapeutic relationship, we can get the necessary buy-in from the patients for multiple examinations, imaging, endoscopic procedures that they often undergo. It can also be of help to set them up with a social worker to make sure they have the emotional and financial supports in place to best manage their disease. Clinical trials will also help move us forward, and I always try to keep my FAP patients abreast of these opportunities as they see the science moving forward, the difference that we will make in the lives of their children with FAP, and also the ability to provide the necessary screening within a trial environment can assist with their finances as well.
Dr. Samaner, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your walking us through the ins and outs of duodenal polyposis and FAP. We covered so many wonderful points, including surveillance techniques, management strategies, and finally, chemo prevention. Thrilled to be able to have spoken with you about this today, and just want to thank you again for your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Dr. Germanski, and thank you to the CGA for putting on such a great webinar series for our listeners. Hopefully, I was able to provide some information about the management of FAP and especially of duodenal polyposis and of some exciting opportunities that are coming for chemo prevention and clinical trials for our patients. Thank you again.